mortgage capital markets decisions carry real financial consequences. That's why Optimal Blue commissioned an independent ROI study with MarketWise advisors, analyzing results across hundreds of lenders. The study highlights consistent gains in efficiency, accuracy, and financial performance, including an average $1,006 net benefit per loan. To be notified when the full 2026 Optimal Blue ROI study is released in May, sign up at optimalblue.com/2026-study.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Operations at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Welcome, everybody. Today's Friday. We're recording on Friday, the 16th of January. Monday is the MLK holiday. But we have a great show today. We're going to give you a little bit of a market update, what's happened this week, what to expect next week. But also just do a recap of what has happened in 2026 so far, because there's been a ton of activity geopolitically, economically. There's been a lot that surrounds interest rates, the mortgage market, the housing market that's come out of the administration, some of it through social media posts, some of it through media engagements. Not a ton of detail yet, but a lot of things to keep an eye on here as we get deeper into the first quarter. So we'll get to that here in just one sec. First, a little bit of data. The OBMMI is right around six, so I'll call it six-ish. We did hit the five handle briefly on some of the news last week, which we'll talk about here again, just about the GSEs being instructed to buy some MBS off the market. The 10-year is still around 4.2, so mainly we're seeing a drop down in mortgage rates that's not necessarily corresponding with the 10-year. So you're seeing that spread between mortgages and the 10-year reduce, get smaller, which is a good thing. And we're much closer or right at where we were pre-pandemic, which is, you know, showing a bit more health in that market, even if it is being pushed a little bit by some extraneous factors. So let's go check in with Alex and James and see what's going on with the market. Okay, James, Alex, welcome. It is, it's Friday. I mentioned we're recording this on Friday because of the Martin Luther King holiday on Monday. There is a bevy of items to talk about, not just recent economic numbers to give you, but we feel like it would be good too after that to do a bit of a recap on what's happened over the past couple weeks, because we certainly hit the ground hard in 2026 in terms of geopolitical action, ideas about home affordability, just a lot that affects us directly and somewhat directly in terms of interest rates and certainly with housing. So where to begin? I thought we could just begin with just some concrete stuff. What happened over this last week in terms of economic numbers? We forecast the CPI number last time we talked, came in pretty benign, pretty close to what we expected. Is that right?
Yeah, it came in right where we were expecting it, right about 2.75%, came in 2.6. Expectations were for 2.7. So slightly cooler than was expected. Shelter was surprisingly muted, even though they did update it this time around. Came in at 0.4%, which was really the one I was keeping an eye on, just because, as we all know, the December reading for shelter was just brought forward from September during the government shutdown. And so that created an extremely muted inflation reading last time around. So that was the one I was keeping an eye on. But no, shelter seemed in a decent spot. And what seemed to really pop things on this particular release was food was up 0.7%. So that was dragging things up. But no, everything, the headline numbers came in as expected.
Yeah. Still defying gravity. It bears repeating that we have inflation that's, you know, relatively tame by recent standards, despite all the tariff discussions and still capacity issues. But some of that is some of the things that you mentioned and have been mentioned in the news. I don't know about others out there. Well, I guess I do know. We were in Arizona this week. You drive by gas stations. I know in Denver, we're getting close to the one handle on gasoline, which is, I think, one of those sort of macro ways I feel like you can drive down inflation or hold inflation lower, because fuel goes into everything, right? like the lettuce has to get to the store and it arrives in a truck after it gets off of a boat or whatever. So fuel in general can kind of lower the tide, if you will, and energy in general, especially as you get into the winter months with things like heating. But yeah, we're still not seeing the major increases we thought we would from tariffs. What else did we have this week? I mean, PPI similar, a little bit higher though, right? So it does seem like producers are potentially, and retailers potentially, still absorbing some of those increases where we do see increases in costs.
Yeah. PPI was a delayed value. It was the November values. It does actually speak well to what Alex was saying. The main driver this month was in food. And what you can see within it was fruits and vegetables were what was really kind of pushing that. So everyone's getting their winter stews together, I guess. But that's what drove the producer's side of it. And that does show them up core to 3.5%. So above inflation expectations, it's above where you want it. It does kind of look like the producers continue to eat that cost of the tariff, but that's good news on the consumer side of things, kind of leveling out.
Yeah. For those of us, again, in the mortgage industry, you think about this as when times get a little bit tighter, margins get a little bit thinner, and there was likely some excess capacity there over the past 5 years as companies were raising prices. They have a little bit of margin that they can let out. And interesting, you mentioned vegetables. I guess I'm kind of guessing now, but we haven't seen the full seasonality of what tariffs could look like. But this time of year, obviously, we're not growing potatoes in Idaho, right? Idaho's frozen by now. So we are probably certainly importing more fruits and vegetables from countries in warmer climates. Let's see. Yes, Monday is the MLK holiday. So are we expecting much in the way of data after that for the remaining 4 days of the week?
We have GDP readings come out on Wednesday for Q3. Those should come in pretty high, driven by CapEx and AI spending, as we've seen over the last few quarters. It'd be interesting to see if there's any catch up with the general economy. I wouldn't expect there to be. I think it's going to be a continuation of what we've come to expect from those GDP readings, where tech and the AI boom in general are dragging along the rest of the economy. And then it's not a data release, but we should get some Supreme Court case rulings, namely in regards to Lisa Cook. We'll be having arguments about her potential removal from her position and the cascading effect that could have, being if it is deemed that she can be removed for being under investigation, that Powell could also potentially be removed for also being under investigation for criminal charge, even if they haven't been made or found to be guilty of said charge.
Right. That's a super interesting stat there, because that just would be immediate precedent for the Powell situation, you're saying, if the Supreme Court allows Lisa Cook to be basically indicted, then...
Right. And it would make what we talked about last week, it would make the DOJ's decision to file these charges with less than 4 months in Powell's tenure remaining, it would make it look like a little bit more politically savvy move, given that they could have him removed just about immediate effect.
Right. All right. I think that's a good segue. Let's get right into a recap. A ton has gone on in this first couple weeks of the year. And again, a lot of it either directly affects interest rates or indirectly affects the housing market. So a lot of it surrounds the Fed. So we just kind of wanted to go note by note here and just opine really quick, riff on these items again, in case anybody missed it on the last few podcasts, because I think this is super important and all leads up to where we are today on Friday. I'm sure things will happen over the weekend as well, but we touched the 5 handle on the OBMMI, which was a super exciting moment. We hit like 5 3/9, right? Like 5.999, a little above that now, the new, kind of the possible criminal charges against Jerome Powell sent rates back up earlier this week, but not back to the levels they were at previously, which was more like 6.125. So let's go. I'll just kind of riff them off and we can talk through where we're at on these items. There's not a ton of updates on these, as kind of expected. A lot of these came from social media posts or kind of headlines from speaking engagements around the administration, mostly President Trump, but still have a lot to a lot that remains to be explained, I would say, over the coming weeks and months. It could be really good for our industry if these are hints or kind of starting points for some initiatives from the White House over this first quarter. So, I mean, the first thing I would mention that I think got a lot of haunches up around our industry was the announcement on social media that the GSEs were going to be instructed to purchase $200 billion of MBS. We held a special bonus episode last Friday on this subject, and we riffed on it a little bit then, and since then, no plans have been divulged or may possibly even been developed, but it seems like this is something that will probably happen, and probably happen hopefully in the near future. But again, we don't know what coupons, we don't know how long this program will take. We don't know if there will be additional funds added to this effort, right? We noted that $200 billion is, it's a lot of money, but it's a drop in the bucket when it comes to buying interest-bearing assets, especially by an entity as large as the GSEs. You know, the Fed purchased many trillions of MBS during COVID and before that, leading all the way back to the Great Financial Crisis. We also saw the Fed buy a ton of treasuries during that time. And $200 billion was less than a week's worth of what they were buying at one point. So not a ton, but still could be an indication of things to come. So I don't know that I would make any changes to your strategy today based on that, other than, you know, we could be looking at better rates as we get further into 2026. I mean, would you gentlemen add anything to that?
It very much seems the real question is there going to be additional funding after that $200 billion? Is this the beginning of a second quantitative easing, or is it just this one hit to try and lower rates? If it's this one hit, it could impact for a while, much like we saw that five handle for a day here, but it's not going to stick around as long. So that feels like the lingering question that everyone's waiting for.
Agreed. If you think back to the beginning of the pandemic, obviously different situation. The every asset class was struggling. The financial markets were they were threatening to collapse. But the Fed came in with a limited checkbook. I forget what the number was, but it was in the hundreds of billions. And they went out into open market operations, bought a ton of MBS. Rates plummeted briefly, but very quickly snapped back up. So I suppose we could see something similar where that demand comes in, snatches up a ton of MBS, rates drop for days, weeks, maybe months, but then the market kicks back in and we end up back where we were. But obviously back then the Fed came out and said, we have a blank check. We will buy bonds until the bonds are gone. And then that's how we had, you know, 2.5% interest rates for so long. So to your point, there's going to need to be more than $200 billion to make a major dent for a long period of time. So we mentioned the Lisa Cook situation possibly having an impact on the renewed attack on Powell. So to remind everybody, that was last weekend. If you haven't watched it, there's a 2-minute video out there of Jerome Powell explaining that he had been basically served a subpoena for possible criminal charges against him for his handling of the rebuilding or the renovations of several Federal Reserve buildings, historic Federal Reserve buildings. So that was definitely an escalation in this attack on Powell, just as a person, but also indirectly an attack on the Fed potentially, and maybe a message to the incoming chairperson of the Fed. And I liked your take on this, Alex, just that if rates popped back up, which is not what anybody wanted, because obviously a big reason that the Fed is in the crosshairs is because the Fed is not implementing rate policy that the White House would like to see. The White House doesn't feel like they've been aggressive enough in cutting rates. But also it got the haunches up, I think, of some other representatives, even GOP representatives, saying we don't like what's going on at this point. We may have issues with whoever you nominate to replace Powell. And we might start blocking those people because we're worried that this is yet another step towards trying to own the Fed.
Yeah, on the back of the news last week of the DOJ serving Powell with papers over the weekend, a subpoena Republican from North Carolina, Tillis, he made it very clear that he would block any appointees, given his spot on the Senate Banking Committee, that he would block any nominees anywhere, whether it's Powell's replacement or Lisa Cook replacement. He would block any nominee from moving forward in the selection process. And I don't know what a Supreme Court ruling would do to the way this currently works, but the way it currently works is if Powell or if anybody else does not have a confirmed successor by the Senate, they will continue to serve in their role, which potentially opens the door to, you know, if, you know, Tillis is blocking nominees, Powell could continue to serve his term longer than May. So that's a door that's open out there. I don't know if the Supreme Court were to come down and say that Lisa Cook needs to be removed immediately, and then by effect of that ruling, that Powell would also need to be removed, if that would mean that they're out, and then, you know, would we have empty seats at that point? I think that's kind of the world we operate in right now. Of these are, there's a first time for these things, and we're currently in it. So that's something to keep in mind. And like you said, this DOJ handling did seem to get pushback from congressional Republicans. And I was reading some things that it even seems to have caught the executive a little bit off guard. Seeing some more reports out there that Pam Bondi, the AG, is in a little bit of hot water right now with Trump. And then that this DOJ, like I said, the DOJ subpoena to Powell caught the executive a little bit off guard as well. So it remains to be seen. There's a lot of moving wheels here, but it really just remains to be seen how the Supreme Court comes down on this, and then how strong those congressional Republicans are in their ability to hold out on nominees.
Right. As we've said, if nothing else, the administration is creative and will always have you kind of on your heels. I mean, even I think Jamie Dimon commented on how he felt like Jamie Dimon, the CEO of Chase, he felt like he had kind of had the administration and President Trump figured out, but this one surprised him a little bit. And he's like, I don't know what to do with this, but I know it's not going to be good for banks. It's not going to be good for anybody if the Fed continues to lose its reputation as being independent.
Keeping on Chase and the banks and the administration making new moves is the potential cap on credit cards at 10%, right? So if they're only allowed to charge 10%, a lot of these banks, including JP Morgan, step forward and they're saying, hey, we are going to have to change our risk management then, right? We have a lot of people who have a FICO score, let's say under 720, that we would just have to cut out. Or, you know, the limit on your credit card, we might need to lower. So it would have a lot of impact on liquidity and credit, which, you know, the modern market, especially America, is built on debt and the ability to spend. So that would be a huge change. How they actually intend to implement that, would it be, hey, over a trailing period, you need to get down to 10%? Or, you know, it's 10% is maybe the opening bid. Maybe it's 15, maybe it's 16 is kind of the conversation there. But there's a lot of ideas right now coming out of the administration. It almost feels like throwing things against the wall to see what's going to stick.
Yeah, as you've said, it's like flooding the zone. It happened a little bit after the inauguration, right? There was this flood of executive orders. Just which one do we focus on? Which ones are serious? Which ones are really going to change the country? And it feels like this early year flood is similar in terms of geopolitical issues and all of these financial initiatives. Yeah, the credit card one is another one. If you haven't read about that, there's a proposed 10% cap for a year on credit cards, which, as you said, bank models aren't set up that way. And I've also read just the behavioral issues that could cause, where on the flip side, right? It's, I know when we were all young, a lot of us got into trouble with credit cards at 20%+. But that kind of teaches you a lesson when you start seeing how that interest adds up. If that interest was cut in half or cut in a third, I don't know that my behavior would have been better, probably worse. Said, all right, 10%, I could borrow more now, or I'm going to continue to carry this debt, and might not have changed behaviors as quickly as something as almost punitive as a 20-30% rate. Again, maybe it's an opening offer, maybe it's just sort of a shot across the bow, like we need to figure something out in terms of affordability of credit. Let's keep it going with some of the financial stuff, and then I want to get to the geopolitical as well, because that is also flooding the zone. Just today, so as we were recording this, there was this announcement, again, a little scant on details, but creativity, about allowing borrowers to use 401k funds as down payments for a home. As far as I know right now, not a ton of of detail on that, right, Alex? I assume it would have some tax implications. Like, you don't have to pay the 10% penalty that you normally would to take money out of your 401k early. But what else could you think could the administration be thinking here?
Yeah, scant on details as this just came out this morning. Again, we're recording on Friday the 16th. This one seems like one that I think could have legs to it. Like you said, it would really come down to how many workarounds they can get for the tax carve outs. As you noted, there's a 10% penalty for withdrawing from your 401k before the retirement age. In addition to that, you know, what's going to happen to the cap gains tax on those assets that you hold in that account? And it's a shame James had to hop a little bit early today, but he was pointing out, oh, what's keeping me from funneling a large proportion of my paycheck through my 401k and then using that as down payments on homes if you're, you know, in a position to do that. So I think there's a lot of kinks to work out there, but I do think that this is one that they could make work. But I don't think at the end of the day, it addresses one of the core problems in the housing market in the U.S. today, which is it's a supply problem. What this is going to do is just add more buyers to the market and drive housing costs up, most likely.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if they were to do the trifecta, right, waive the 10%, waive capital gains, and if you're using a non-Roth 401k, like waive the income tax on that somehow, so I completely avoid income tax forever, I could see that being a pretty big tax advantage. And but to your point, then do 401ks become this weird intermediary where you're, you know, first half of the year, you dump all your income into the 401k and then pull it directly out? Could that have, I don't know, cause fluctuations in the stock market artificially? Could that gaming the system, I don't know, lead people to other loopholes? Who knows? So it'd be interesting to see once the I don't know, the rest of the administration and the interns get a hold of this, you know, what they find and what they come up with. But again, we have to encourage creativity from the FHFA and from the administration. This could be one of those things that pushes affordability to a better place. But to your point, it potentially raises the price of housing again. And does this start to defeat itself until we have just a glut of supply that may have to come from, you know, hammering away at the lock-in effect, for instance, for, you know, figure out a way to get these folks like myself who have a 3% mortgage out of their current mortgages and moving to a new home.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like I said, I think this is one that could have some steam behind it just because there's already 401k carve-outs for, you know, taking a loan against your 401k without penalties for a certain period of time and under certain conditions. So I think there's some precedent that's already out there for this.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And again, we're not financial advisors, but of course there's the thought that you want to have money in your 401k. Like your home can't be your only, I believe, can't be your only retirement plan. Like you do need to participate in the stock market no matter how old you are, just to have some skin in that game and to diversify your investment strategy, because most of us these days don't have a pension to look forward to. We have to save money to be able to retire at some point in our, you know, 60s or later. And the only other, you know, not the only other, but the other financial thing we wanted to bring up that directly affects us in the mortgage industry would be just the ban on institutional buyers of homes. There's been continued debate on that. Again, no plan specifically, but read about this one if you haven't, or go back and listen to one of our podcasts from a couple weeks ago. The White House is moving towards banning institutions, whatever an institution gets to be defined as, which, Alex, you pointed out, we don't know what that looks like yet. Is that a mom and pop that maybe have accumulated 10 plus properties, or does it only mean a hedge fund or a bank? Because there are hedge funds who have invested in certain parts of the country, and sometimes it's a good thing. They've invested where home prices were dropping and they've come in to prop up that market and rent those homes out. But also some folks think that activity has artificially pushed prices higher and pushed them high enough where in some places it becomes unaffordable for people to buy their first home or even their second home.
Absolutely. One more. You mentioned lock-in, and I wanted to bring up one more thing on the financial front before we move on to geopolitics. I don't know if you saw this, but Bill Ackman's also been throwing a couple ideas at the wall in regards to mortgages. And he was saying a possible way to get lower rates would be to have a lock-in on when you are allowed to refinance. You know, you could get a lower rate if you agree not to refinance within 5 years or within 10 years, which would, you know, make those cash flows a little bit stickier, without paying a penalty. So that's just another idea that's floating out there. I've seen a little bit of commentary, both supporting and against it, but just another one that, you know, if I think if that were to get maybe some official word on it from someone within the administration, I think we could be having that conversation as well.
Yeah, the old prepayment penalty. For those of you who were around before the great financial crisis, many loans, especially ARM loans, especially like Alt-A and subprime, had prepayment penalties, which meant you could not, you would incur a penalty if you paid off the loan or refinanced it within 2 to 5 years. And you got a better rate for that. And that feels, you know, in the parlance of bond speak, that's callability, right? A bondholder will pay more for a bond if the payments are guaranteed for a certain period of time. Because the worry is you buy a bond, you pay 105 cents on the dollar for it, and you get a 6% payment every year, but it pays off in 6 months. You just lost money, right? But if you're guaranteed 3 years of interest from that, you at least make your money back plus a premium. And therefore, you could offer a rate that is lower. Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Ackman's a pretty creative guy in his own right and thinks about it from kind of the investment strategy side of the business. And that would be a way to get rates, you know, it used to be you could get a quarter, 3/8, even half a point lower for that callability feature. So we'll see where that goes. I mean, that kind of was done away with after the great financial crisis, but I don't know that that was one of the more dangerous features of these loans as much as it was, you know, the fact you didn't have to divulge your credit score or your assets or your income. All right. That's a really good one too. I think, again, we have to encourage creativity and maybe all these things add up to better affordability here as we get deeper into 26. And the geopolitics, that's also something that bears repeating because there's so much going on there that it's difficult to focus on any one item or read enough articles or watch enough coverage. But as you probably know, we made a surgical attack on Venezuela and arrested Nicolas Maduro, who's the leader of Venezuela at the time. Right now, Venezuela is kind of in limbo in a transition period, being just kind of run by his socialist government at the moment. But we have grand plans to do something there, and I think we have to because we were the folks who essentially destabilized the government of Venezuela. Read what you want about the reasons we did that. Drugs is one possibility. Oil is another. It's probably a combination of things. And the question is always, what's next, right? Iran has been in the news heavily over this past week. Just horrible tragedy over there with the there's been just unrest, which, as we know over history, can result in good things over time, but in the short term can result in a lot of deaths. And there are over 2,000 deaths at least reported in Iran from those protests. And it looked like to me and to many people, we were going to intervene at some point mid this week. But from most accounts, there's an eerie quiet over there right now. Like things have kind of quieted down, but Trump did tweet that help is on the way. And we did kind of, you know, we've attacked Iran before last June, so it wasn't outside of the realm of possibilities that we would do that again. But right now we seem to be standing down, although I think word as of yesterday is we're moving a lot of our hardware from some of it from the Caribbean, from the Venezuela conflict into the Middle East, which would be, you know, maybe a harbinger of something happening later on this month or in February. Because I think, I know I read another article that said Trump was informed that we didn't have enough hardware in that region to do a full-on strike. So if we had made a move earlier this week, we might have risked lives we didn't have to and might have not been as effective as we needed to be. You read anything else on that, Alex, just in terms of what might, I mean, again, we're just speculating as much as anybody in the news right now on what might happen there.
Yeah, no, I think it's no secret that the Trump administration and the U.S. government in general for decades now has been interested in regime change in that country. And like you said, there's at least 2,000 deaths, likely, highly likely, more than that. These people were just, you know, protesting the cost of living in the country. So a real tragedy there. It does appear that potentially those threats that he made or in conjunction with the crackdown that was done by the Iranian government, both resulted in these protests diminishing. But we'll have to see. I haven't read about our allocation of assets too much across the Mediterranean and the Caribbean, but it wouldn't be any shock to me that we're moving things away from Venezuela now. I think Venezuela remains an open question, but it's no secret to me that I think we want to knock out a couple more of the bad guys around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, seems very overt. It's kind of wild how just transparent most of this is. The reasons may not be completely transparent, but it does seem like when the crosshairs are on that we follow through. You know, who knows what happens with Greenland? I believe we're the largest military occupation of that country, so I don't know that it would take a ton of hardware to do whatever we plan to do there, or if it would even be a military situation versus a diplomatic.
Yeah, that one seems like that'd be a really silly one to get physically violent over, in my opinion. I mean, everyone's already been talking about that. I mean, it would likely spell the end of NATO. We already been in semi-hot water with the Europeans just back and forth over, you know, their spending on NATO, the Ukraine-Russia conflict, and everyone's contributions to that. But it would be a large misstep, in my opinion, for us to do something violent over Greenland, although I do think we will end up with it at some point. I don't think the Europeans would risk their relationships with us over in the long term.
Right. Okay. And then maybe a similar situation with Cuba. You know, sad situation there as well. Venezuela was doing a bit to prop up the Cuban economy, supply them with fuel, these things. Cuba was already just in really rough economic poverty shape. So doesn't feel like that would be a situation where we would intervene militarily, but might need to intervene even just on a humanitarian level and may need to assist. There's been, you know, rumors that we would help assist rebuild their government there.
Yeah, in my opinion, I think the one that could be a successful transition to some new form of government that's most recently would be Cuba. If you were to ask me about Iran, Venezuela, and Cuba, I mean, Cuba's been on our list since the revolution in 59. They've been under sanctions since 61, 62. And I think there's individuals who have a personal, it's personal for them in the administration, namely Marco Rubio, who his family comes from Cuba. So we'll have to see what happens there. I don't think it would take much, in all honesty, to topple that regime, but I don't want to speak out of turn on that either. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, I think journalists would agree with you. Since the Castros are no longer in power there, and kind of the lifting of some of the embargoes did a little bit for tourism, from what I've read. There's some resorts there, and those resorts are doing quite well. But it's another situation where you have haves and have-nots that are growing further and further apart economically. And some of that is honestly from folks who have moved from Cuba to the U.S. and are sending dollars back to Cuba. And so those residents actually have a little bit of money in their pocket, but those that don't have relatives in the U.S. or in Europe really hurting, you know, for simple things like water and electricity.
Yep. Yeah. Say, I mean, that's a trend across all three of these countries we're talking about is, U.S. dollar liquidity is a major problem for all three.
Yes. Okay. And meanwhile, we still have the war in the Ukraine. We have the war in Gaza, just a very, very unstable global political environment, geopolitical environment, yet getting back to rates have not dropped on any of this kind of instability. And that, I think that goes to everything we've talked about and you'll hear about from any economist who cares to talk about it these days. It's just there's so much upward pressure on rates from, again, from all these things we've talked about. You know, if NATO is going to, whether they're going to dissolve or not, we have made it clear that the other NATO allies need to double their spending on defense. There's trillions of dollars worth of debt involved with that, including our own, that's increasing. And then the tech debt that we've talked about with all the investment in AI, much of that does not come from equity or cash. It comes from, again, raising more and more debt. So the fact that we hit the 5 handle recently on the OBMMI, I think is pretty exceptional. And I would not expect to go much lower. And most people don't. But as soon as we say that, something will happen or we will get creative again, or we will intervene in another situation that drives rates just a little bit lower. So you take the good with the bad right now, I suppose.
Yeah, no, rates popping a little bit this morning just on news. Trump threatening tariffs on those who oppose our potential annexation of Greenland, which could, you know, undo all the tariff negotiations that have occurred over the past 8 months.
Right. Sounds like similar with Iran. Basically, we're using those tariffs again as a threat to say, if you don't back us in our endeavors or our ambitions right now, we're going to use financial retribution, which is it is a tool, and it is a nonviolent tool. All right. I'm sure we missed a couple of things there, Alex, but we believe these are the things to keep an eye on, especially as it relates to interest rates, the housing market, the mortgage industry. And we will talk again about things very soon, and we'll always have a bonus episode if something really big comes out kind of midweek.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you, James. Thank you, Alex. Appreciate the time. Appreciate the wisdom. Take care. All right. Let's wrap this thing up. Thanks so much, Alex, James. World-class conversation, wisdom, as always. Thank you so much. A lot going on. Don't forget our summit. The Optimal Blue Summit is coming up here in a little over a month. summit.optimalblue.com is the website to go register. Check out the agenda. Check out our list of speakers, which grows every week, by the way. So if you haven't checked it out recently, go check that out. That's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning in to Optimal Insights.
Speed matters in lending, and borrowers expect instant answers. But traditional loan locking ties you to a desk, slowing decisions and creating friction. That's why Optimal Blue introduced mobile locking in our mobile app. Now, loan officers can lock loans anytime, anywhere, fast, secure, and accurate. Access your live pipeline, update loan details, run pricing, and complete locks right from your phone. No delays, no desk dependency. Just instant action that enhances the borrower experience. Unlike browser-based tools, mobile locking is built into our native iOS and Android app for faster load times, stronger security, and a seamless experience. And the best part? It's included at no extra cost for all Optimal Blue PPE users. Download the Optimal Blue mobile app today and start locking loans on the go. Access, price, lock, it's that simple.